So if adoption is in some way excluded from this process, we would certainly give it strong support. Another aspect is the question of visitation, as it was written here. We didn't really understand whether that could extend to a mandatory program of visiting on the part of other people in an adoptive situation. We feel that this is very, very difficult. There is a movement in the community to promote what is called open adoption, and there are people active in Eugene and elsewhere about it, in which the birth parents do maintain a contact with the adoptive parents. But in our experience, that's a very new thing that we tested, and it would tend, we feel, to kind of chill the potential involvement of the adoptive family, or perhaps their willingness to take the child if a mandatory visitation program were established by this law. The other aspect that concerned us was that it wasn't clear in the material here whether or not the existence of a two-year relationship, or as it may be redefined, was the only status that would give a person the right to intervene. And what we see sometimes is, after careful work with a young mother who is about to give birth, she may make a decision to relinquish a child for adoption. And we really do work very hard to make sure that she feels is a good decision for her if she's working with an agency. Oftentimes her parents may not be in accord with that decision and may come out really very strong. We feel that the birth parent really has to have the right to make that decision. And certainly if it's a case of having an established psychological parenthood, that wouldn't apply to a baby. But as this material looked as though it were written, it was either the parent-child relationship, or it was some kind of contest whether or not this kind of intervention was in the best interest of the child. We could see if every parent who disagreed with their child who was relinquishing a child for adoption, that could really add a very complicated dimension to the placement of children.
Okay.
I don't think I have anything else to add except to concur with what CSD testified to and what Mr. Hansen from Albertina Curtis testified to. Boys and Girls Aid had the same concerns. The Handman Gross version, which was just handed to me by Mr. Phillips, does indicate that the provisions in relation to adoption have been stricken. And if that is the version which would be passed out of this committee, Boys and Girls Aid could support this at this time, as well as the definition for parent-child relationships, which has been added.
You got something you just got handed now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you
for your patience throughout this long afternoon.
Yeah. And my day is probably only beginning. Well, let's see. Now, Katrinka Darter signed up.
My name is Trinka Darter, and I am the step-parent in question that the bill was initially drafted for. When I was 18 years old, I married a man who had a one-year-old and a two-year-old from a previous marriage. I have assumed all the responsibilities of parenthood, and I have become their psychological parent by virtue of the fact that I have met all their needs, emotional and physical, for the last 12 years. 3 years ago, I divorced my now ex-husband, and at that point I was given no consideration as to custody with my stepchildren because I had no legal standing in court. Earlier you mentioned the possibility of having done a step-parent adoption. That didn't apply in my case. I brought that up while I was married, but my ex-husband was sexually abusing my stepdaughter, and that precluded any possibility of my being able to do a step-parent adoption. He knew that if I had any legal rights with the stepchildren, that I would leave him and take them away also, and I would have. My stepchildren are now 14 and 15 years old. My stepdaughter is 15, and she has been sexually abused by her dad since she was 7 years old. My stepson is 14 years old now. He has been wetting the bed consistently for the last 4 years. My ex-husband places no emotional attachment to that. He thinks that it's just something that happens. He doesn't put any importance on the possibility of the emotional damage that has been done to my son.
Their mother's deceased, is she, or what?
No, she has had very brief encounters with the kids for the first 9 years or so. She would come about once a year and stay maybe a weekend, but she's never had the bonding that I have had with them. Marion County Family Court has determined that I am the kids' psychological mother and that I should have some say in their upbringing. My stepson has been classified as learning disabled. He is 14 years old and he reads at a first grade level. The kids, since they have been living with my ex-husband this past 3 years, have been moved now 14 different times. They are now living in California. I don't even know where they're at now. If I had legal standing in court, I would at least be able to go forward and present the judge with this kind of damning evidence, because my stepchildren have no possibility of any continuity of a relationship. My ex-husband moves them every 2 to 3 months, and so they're going to sometimes 4 different schools in 1 school year. This prohibits them from forming long-term relationships with either adults or with their peer group. They have no close friends, and all this moving around does is it reinforces the dependence that they have on my ex-husband, which is an emotional need of his. Psychological evaluations were done last fall, and they found that my ex-husband does have a personality thought disorder. Yes, there is a possibility that he would reoffend and do the sexual abuse again, and that he takes no responsibility for his own actions. He does not care what has been done to the kids emotionally this past 3 years. 14 moves for young teenagers is ridiculous. There's just no reason for that.
Well, if the bill passes, it wouldn't help you, would it?
Yeah, actually it would. I would be able to petition the court here in Marion County for custody of my stepchildren.
Well, I thought you said they lived in California.
Well, they're in California now, but if it wouldn't go through here in Marion County, there's a provision written into the bill where I can go to the county in which they're living, provided I can find the county in which they're living, and then petition there to file for custody of the kids. I think that I present a pretty fair case, and had I been allowed to present this in front of a judge 3 years ago, possibly all this would not have happened to the kids, I mean. Last year, they were arrested for breaking into people's cars and stealing things. They were then 13 and 14. When they live with my ex-husband, they have no discipline. They have no rules, regulations. They have an open door policy with him. They ran from the police when they were apprehended for breaking into cars, but they were caught and they had to do a day of community service here in Marion County and write a 500-word essay.
Yeah, I think I understand what the situation is, Mrs. Darter. I really question whether this would help you if you had to go to California, but I'm not going to worry about it. The bill sounds reasonable, but I'm just wondering how practical it's going to be if you're trying to get custody of kids in California. I'll let somebody else.
Well, at some point, if my ex-husband should come back into this state, then I could have him served here.
That's right.
And that's probably a likely situation also, as I do have 2 natural children who are 7 and 8. I have total custody of them, and he has very restricted visitation, but I can assume that at some point in the future he will want to make contact with them, so I will be able to serve him at that point.
Okay, all right, fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
They have, there's Grace Jackson.
My name is Grace Jackson, and I am the grandparent of a child that has been in a custody situation for most of his life. He's 11 years old now. And
like custody of who?
Well, between my daughter and my ex-son-in-law, back and forth and back and forth.
Uh-huh.
And when I appeared before the House Judiciary, my husband and I had standing in court as grandparents and interveners. But and his attorney had said, my grandson's attorney had said, that neither parental home would be recommended. And our grandson's child psychiatrist recommended, because of our bonding with our grandson and the fact that we were his psychological parents, that we should have custody. But in the course of maneuvering and being able to extend the custody hearing for almost a year, because of rotation, it's gone into another judge's hands now, and he has declared that we have no standing in court, that ours was based on the child's rights and not grandparents' rights. And we have no standing, and our grandson has been put into children's services control. Had we had standing, we probably would have him with us now. All we want is our day in court.
Right.
Please let us at least get there.
All right. I do believe, Mr. Jackson, that the child would be entitled to be represented by independent counsel who would then represent the child's best interest. Was that the case?
Yes, he was.
Uh-huh. Did the boy's attorney recommend that he be placed in
the court? That has not been completed yet. That portion has not been completed yet. However, it depends on the attorney, just like anything else. And I know what our grandson wants.
Yeah.
But the child's attorney can recommend whatever he decides is right for the child.
Yes.
And the child may not truly be represented.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Jackson. Well, any other witnesses out here on this? Okay, Mike.
My name is Mike Greenfield. I'm the director for the Marion County Family Court. Judge Norvath regrets that he can't be here. He worked with the Juvenile Rights Project and Children's Services Division on the some compromise language, which got by safely passed the on the House side, and he's been in some more trouble over here, and so was pleased to work with the Children's Services Division, Father Pascal, on these changes. And as I understand them, the ones that you were just handed, adoption has been deleted, and the language which has to do with the standing of the people described in this bill with reference to placement have to do with domestic relations proceedings and juvenile court proceedings. And I think there's a good definition in the added section 4, which talks about what the parent-child relationship is and defines it much more clearly. So I just wanted to get that onto the, to the record.
So apparently everybody's come together on the Hannah Gross amendments of this date, is that it?
That's right. We found a typewriter, and so I think everybody is in agreement at this point that this
okay,
is suitable.
I'll see if this is put on for work session. We'll try to get it on Tuesday if we can. We're getting kind of jammed up, as you know, but I'll try.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll get it on sometime.
The placement language in this is not meant to encompass adoptions. They're simply other types of placement. Thank you.
Yes, all right, thank you. Anyone else now on 2460? Okay, I'll declare the public meeting on Hospital 2460 closed. Maybe we should take a 5-minute break around.
Yeah.
We're going to take a 5-minute recess to give our computer operator a chance to cool his fingers off. It's 4:25. We'll come back here in 5 minutes or so. And just a minute before we leave, let me tell you what the order is going to be. So What do we got left?
2228, 2334,
2361.
Listen
in, I know you're going too fast. We have 2258, 2361, 2334. Where am I missing that one? 2795. No, we've already heard that one. 2222. Okay, that's four bills. That's all that I think we've got left. Now, has anybody out there got another bill in mind? Okay. What we'll do is we will take care of. I'm going to call 2334 next, and then I'm going to call 2361 next. And I'm doing that because there are people from long distances on both of those. And then I'll call 2258 next. That's just one witness. And then I'll call 2222. Okay? Where are we doing?
Okay. You probably haven't had a chance to look at this. The schedule.
Well, let's go in your office and look at it right now.
Okay.
Right there. Is this one here?
That's it.
Oh, all right. Cool. It's 4:40 p.m. and the Senate Judiciary Committee will reconvene. The Senate requires the subcommittee one to hear public testimony on House Bill 2334. We've got everybody's rushing to get up there.
And leave. Chairman,
Frank Donald with the Oregon Banking Association. House Bill 2334, A and Bills, as you have it before you, addresses three issues dealing with construction liens. It's a skinny version of its former self. The three versions that come to you from the House, the three sections that come to you from the House are agreed by all parties. Sections 1 and 2 clarify that the 15-day time period for response to a notice requiring a list of materials and supplies does not include Saturdays, Sundays, and other holidays. Section 3 of the bill provides that.
Just a minute, let me get straight now. Where are
2334?
I know, but I don't. We're talking about a hand and gross bill.
A and gross.
Okay. Go ahead. I was looking for hand and gross.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes, it's a two-page.
There's two pages. Sections 1 and 2 exclude Saturdays, Sundays from the and holidays from the response time.
Yes, all right.
Section 3 of the bill provides that when anyone files a claim for a lien, not only do they mail a notice to the owner that the claim has been filed, they also mail a notice to the mortgagee. And that normally happens. Most of those involved will give us a notice because they understand our concern. We're frequently the construction loan operator and paying out the construction loan funds. And when there is a dispute or a claim, they want us notified. This codifies that that's a requirement. We believe that if that notice is required, the mortgagee will be able to assist in the possible remedy. The claimant wants to be paid, a notice to both the owner and the mortgagee makes sense in that regard. In Section 4 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, we are requesting that no lien shall bind any improvement for longer than the period of 120 days instead of the present 180 days. The 120 days, we think, is ample for the claimant to bring suit. And by reducing the time frame, the parties, hopefully the parties will negotiate the problem in a more timely manner. Our experience tells us that we get serious about these things at 150 days. We think by reducing it to 120 days, we'll get serious much quicker, get the project underway again, and the remedy will occur in a more timely fashion.
Just a minute, please.
How long are you planning?
Oh, I can move.
How many do you need?
I've been getting along so far with just me. And anybody else is welcome to join me.
Okay.
Go ahead.
We ask for your support. Responding questions.
Okay. Senator Pryor, for the record, my name is John Gervais. I represent the Construction Industry Committee. It's a group of 14 different organizations like electrical contractors and plumbing contractors and material suppliers and what have you. We, as Mr. Barney said, all have reached agreement on this particular revision to the lien law. While we were not supportive of the original, the introduced bill, we feel that there is some justification for some of these changes and that there are some things that we can live with.
All right, thank you.
Take a lot of your time.
Chair Mike Scott, I'm an attorney from Tiger with the Construction Industry Committee. We just, again, reflect the comments of Mr. DeVay and Mr. Barney. Committee does agree with the bill, and if there are any particular questions, I think my purpose today is to try to address any questions that the UL legal counsel may have about the language or wording of the bill, if you have to address those questions.
Let's see now. The saying here where this notice, it says, I'm looking at section 3, it says the person filing the claim shall mail to the owner and to the mortgagee. There's nothing anywhere that says.
Can I hypothesize the question for you? The question of what mailing means, I guess, is what I may hear you saying, that the word delivery would change to the word mail. ORS 87.018, for the purposes of the construction lien statutes, defines what delivery means. The issue here that was addressed was an additional person which was to be notified by a person who files a construction lien claim within a rather restrictive period of time. And the intent of Section 3 was that the requirement of notice could be fulfilled by the mere mailing within that time period. And it wasn't necessary for either the mortgagee or for the owner to actually have received in their hand at that particular, within that 20-day period of time, the notice of the lien claim had been filed. There's a question as to the status of law at this particular point in time. They may not need to have that within their hand in 20 days. It may be able to be mailed within 20 days. But given the requirement of an additional person having be required to get that notice, we wanted to make sure that the lien claimant can fulfill that requirement of notice simply by sending it, according to the statute, by certified or registered mail to the address of the owner or the address of the mortgagee. And that's why the word mail is in there instead of the word delivered.
Mr. Chairman, our experience indicates that the present practice of delivery to the owner doesn't accomplish a great deal. Most frequently, they will come in after a period of 3 or 4 weeks and say, I wonder what this is. And we think that it will come to their attention in a much more meaningful manner by receiving it in the mail. Many times, this is a home improvement. They may be gone. They may not be living in the dwelling that it's addressed to. And delivered just doesn't prove anything. And we think by notifying the mortgagee, we're certainly going to be in touch with the owner very quickly after we receive that notice. And we think that's the protection for both the mortgagee and the owner.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that at this particular point in time. The mortgagee is required to be given notice of intent to foreclose. And the practice, at least in my office, is that we combine the notice of intent to foreclose and the notice of filing a lien claim. They're two different statutory required notices, but we combine them in one notice. And the practice in our office is then when the mortgagee is indeed notified that those liens are resolved. So I guess what this statute, in essence, is doing is codifying some of the common practice among lien claimant attorneys, which recognizes that those lien claims are cleared up when the mortgagee is given notice.
What about a contract vendor or the owner of a trust deed?
A contract
vendor, where the vendee or the purchaser is having the work done, should the contract vendor get notice, or
well,
does he?
The question, I want to say, Your Honor, the question, Mr. Chairman, is what interest do you want to be subject to a lien? If the contract vendor's interest is going to be subject to a lien, you'd want to provide notice to him. you could provide notice to the contract vendee under equitable conversion, where that vendee would be the owner of the fee-simple title of the property. But if the contract isn't subject to equitable conversion, which means it can't be specifically performed, the contract vendor would be required to be given notice, because that would be the interest which you want to be subject to lien. So the question is, who is the owner? Is the question of what interest do you want to be subject to lien?
Okay. I guess I've got to go down for a call, but I suspect it's just to get a quorum on the floor, so I won't be very long. And so just relax. We'll be in recess just a few minutes. So that the loan would not have to be, I guess the owner would be the contract vendor then. That would include the contract vendor.
It could include the contract vendor if you want his interest to be subject to lien. I always notify the contract vendor because I take the position that no contract is subject to equitable conversion. But if you just wanted to attach that one interest of the vendee, my position would be you give notice to the just to the vendee as the owner. Practice in my office is notice both to the vendor and the vendee.
Okay. What about in trust deed situations?
The trust deed would be construed similar to a mortgage, and the notice would have to be given as a mortgagee.
Is that statutory? Or is that...
I believe there's language in the trust deed section which says for the purposes of most of the code, it shall be construed similar to a mortgage.
All right. Mr. Chairman, that's our belief.
All right. Go ahead.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Bill Bellinger. I'm with the Oregon State Building Trades Council. I didn't expect to be here today. In fact, if the hearing was a lie, wouldn't it? I just want to concur with what these other three gentlemen have to say here. I expressed early concerns with the bill on the House side because it affected the ability to collect employee benefits on the construction lien process, which is used extensively right now by various building trade unions. That was our primary concern. We had several meetings. All parties agreed on the A. Gross version, and I'd recommend a concurrence. I guess that's the word to use.
All right. Well, I'll recommend concurrence. Any objections?
Hearing none.
I think there is one party who's going to suggest something to be done. We'll call Jack Kalinowski up.
My name is Jack Kalinowski. I represent the Associated General Contractor. Mr. Chairman, I believe you have in your file on this bill or somewhere an amendment that we would like to propose and a little narrative regarding it.
He's got three pages. Starts with this page, then there's the page in between, and then there are the proposed amendments for LC 2334A-3.
Well, this page is just an explanation.
It's an explanation.
And this is the proposal. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, many privately funded construction contract documents require the prime contractor to keep the project free from all liens that may be claimed. While there's nothing fundamentally wrong in this concept, hardships that have been extreme have been imposed upon the contractor when that contractor has been notified that a construction lien claim may be made. Significantly, notices of the right to claim a lien are filed with the owner of the property, but there is no similar requirement that such notices be filed with the prime contractor. The purpose of the proposed amendment to House Bill 2334 is to say that such provisions in privately funded construction projects are enforceable only if the contractor is given, in a timely fashion, a copy of the notice that has been filed with the owner. The contractor will then have the opportunity to make certain that all monies due a potential lien claimant will be paid, and the possibility of the prime contractor being subjected to a claim that the prime contractor had no knowledge of will be averted. The amendment will not in any way jeopardize the rights of a claimant, and it should ensure that potential claimants will be satisfied much more rapidly than before enactment of this provision. Now, Mr. Chairman, I've discussed this potential amendment with Mr. Bill Alexander, who's a major supplier of materials to commercial improvement projects. He somewhat avidly supports the concept of this amendment because he recognizes that that means that the supplier of materials of the construction project is going to get paid much sooner than under the present conditions. I discussed it with Mr. John Gervais, who was up here earlier. He has indicated support. We're suggesting this amendment fully with the permission of the requesters at House Bill 2334, the Oregon Bankers Association. And I did discuss this amendment with Mr. Marvin Hall, who's the business agent, I believe, of the Carpenters Union. Mr. Hall indicated that they are also supportive. I happened to talk to him, Mr. Chairman, because the five of the six craft unions that we negotiate labor union agreements with happened to be meeting today with our contractors. As a matter of fact, at this very moment, or at least earlier this afternoon, and we asked them to endorse or support.
Okay, let's see now.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Bob Castagna with the Oregon Catholic Conference. Our concern is, as Ms. Edwards indicated, with the bingo section, and particularly on page 45 and subsection 3B, dealing with the hours during which these records are to be available for police officers and law enforcement agents. We thought that the language that came through the House had an ambiguity to it as to what hours were being referred to. And in speaking to the Department of Justice and to the Commerce Department, we have asked that the words bingo or lotto game be inserted as modifiers before the word business hours so as to clearly indicate that those records would be available during the business hours of the games. Absent that language, a reading might be possible that at any hour that a church is open, a police officer or a law enforcement agent could walk in and request records, and that has a bit of a negative overtone to us.
Okay, is that it?
So okay. If the committee could adopt those amendments, we'd appreciate it and could be supportive of the bill.
I don't think the committee is going to be interested in amending a 56-page bill to stick that in there.
No, they haven't.
Mr. Chairman, we have some conflict amendments prepared by Legislative Council.
Well, we're not through. I mean, you've got more.
Oh, I just discussed this for a little bit. Yeah, it's got some other things besides bingo. So there will, I think, need to be some amendments anyway because of the conflicts with a couple of other bills. If you want me to discuss what those are.
Those are on the way, or?
Yes, Senator Fraud, the main bill is House Bill 2223, which passed a couple of hours ago. It has now been passed by both houses. Related to fees.
I'll explain that
to you. All right. I might talk about the bill. They say what we were looking at with our legislative packages was trying to simplify the statutes so we can improve processing of the paper. One bill was 2223, simplified our fees, which were very, very convoluted. It then affected a lot of other what we've got is long sections, partly to do with fees, partly to do with other kinds of things. And we initially...
Just a minute. Bob, did you leave that... did you write...
Yeah.
Counsel, did you get a note of that?
He's going
to
bring something.
There are copies of the amendments which I've provided to your staff.
Yeah.
Is it in the book?
They're in the book. I gave them to them earlier today.
I didn't dig deep enough. Okay, I got it. Thank you.
To explain the conflict amendments, we had one bill to simplify fees, the other bill to simplify the rest of our processing. If the fee bill then went to Ways and Means and is now passed both houses, this bill is assigned to judiciary, and our plan was to marry them up. in retrospect, perhaps we should have started them married, but we didn't. And so as a result, we do have conflict amendments prepared by legislative council.
Is that LC 2222A-5?
Yes, yes, 6785. It also cleans up a couple of the wording, not, you know, policy kinds of things. Let me explain the genesis of the bill. As they said, was to simplify processing, and what it deals with about three or four different things, by and large. One, it deals with name availability. That was the issue that Mr. Gilbert is interested in. Oregon has now a requirement that we cannot accept documents for filing if their names are the same as or deceptively similar, and so on and so forth. That has created a lot of problems, conflicts with trademark law, and so on. 2 years ago, Mr. Gilbert had a bill which passed both houses, which would have changed that statutory standard, the way we file documents. The bill was vetoed by the governor. So about over a year ago, I brought the protagonist in on that issue, and we spent a lot of time, and we looked up this bill, which I think solves a lot of the name availability problems. And it changes the statutory standard to distinguishable on the record from deceptively similar. It also allows escape hatch, where if somebody has filed your name, has gone in and filed your name, you can file that name if you file an affidavit, that is some business name with an affidavit, saying that in fact you have it, and that solves a lot of the problems that have existed. Some of the other things that the bill does is it eliminates certificates for supplementary filings. The way the statutes are now, once you file a corporation, you get a certificate of incorporation. Every time you do something to that corporation, you amend it, dissolve it, merge it, whatever, we are required to issue another certificate as well as to stamp your document filed and send it back. We don't think anybody has any interest in those certificates. It's just paper. It's expensive. The bill abolishes those supplemental certificates. The bill has been worked on extensively by members of the bar, business community, and they all approved this bill. I can go through some of the other things. It eliminates a report that we're now required to make I'm required to make every year to the director of the Department of Commerce, a statutory requirement that's been in for many, many years. It used to be to the governor. Meaningless report. It allows us to send documents to a mailing address, which is whatever address that the person that's filed with us wants. Right now, when we send documents, renewal forms, for example, we are required to send them to the registered agent of the corporation. The registered agent is often an attorney, has to in turn send them on to the company to get a signature by an officer before they can be sent back to us. It's a delay. If the thing comes in late, the corporation can be dissolved. What this simply says is if they want to give us a mailing address to send stuff, we'll enter that mailing address and that's where we'll send it. It doesn't have to go to the registered agent. One policy, I think policy issue related to professional corporations, which was suggested by some attorneys. Right now, if you file a professional corporation with our office, you also have to register that professional corporation with your licensing board and pay a $25 fee, regardless of whether the licensing board is interested in you doing that or not. This simply makes those registrations optional with licensing boards. It also allows a professional corporation to become any other kind of corporation, a profit, non-profit, or any of those to become a professional corporation. Now, a professional corporation can become a profit corporation under very limited circumstances and vice versa. So we get, for example, psychologists that say, hey, we're a non-profit corporation, I want to become a professional corporation. They can't do it. They've got to dissolve one, set the other. Sometimes there are tax implications. And it relates to us, and that we're the ones that get the pressure because we're the ones that have to tell them they can't do it. And nobody knows any good reason except, you know, that's the way the statutes have been. It defines, it has some definitions for when you have to register an assumed business name, which now is not clear, so that it clarifies when you have to register and for what county you have to register. Yeah, that's a kind of a quick summary. I told Mr. Swank I would give him a section-by-section summary, which I can give to him Monday. But as I say, essentially what we did was go through about the 10 ORS chapters that we administered relating to business corporations, nonprofits, co-ops, professional corporations, limited partnerships, trademarks, assumed business names, and say, let's cleanup stuff that makes it more difficult for our to do our job, requirements that really don't do anything for the public that make it difficult. Reviewed by a task force of attorneys, members in the business community, all support, you know, what we've done here.
Okay, Councilor, any questions? Okay, thanks for your patience in waiting here. I guess we don't have anything else on House Bill 2222.
No.
All right. And you'll be in touch with my staff.
Yes, sir. Yes, I'll be bringing Mr. Swain some things on Monday, and then I hope we have a work session soon.
Okay, and that'll close the public hearing on 2222.
Thank you.
Well, I got a note here. Okay, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2663.
Mr. Chairman, I just talked to Stevie.
Ah, okay.
I was just going to tell you. Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned it. Okay, she's here.
Yeah.
She left her, and I thought I would tell you about it.
Okay.
It had been checked off. I thought you hit it first.
I don't know how that got. I didn't have a sign up sheet, I guess, is the reason that this thing kind of got lost. You didn't sign up on any sheet, did you?
No, I thought you were meeting at 3 and I came too late.
Okay.
Senate Bill 2663. Oh, I'm Stevie Remington, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. And when we sought introduction of Senate Bill 2663, we had about 5 different portions, repealing statutes, portions of which, or all of which, have been struck down by the Oregon appellate courts.
Well, don't we have a Senate bill on the same subject?
We're doing. There was a bill that we sent out the other day that dealt with switchblades. I think this deals with some additional.
There's a Senate bill 553 that deals with one portion of our bill, which is transactional immunity.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, but our bill deals with more than that. And
how come you get? Now what are we going to do? We pass 2 bills to deal with the same subject?
Well, House Bill 2663 has passed the House, and it deals with 2 items now, and I understand that Jack Morris was suggesting that an original portion that was deleted by the House should be reinserted. And but they both deal with transactional immunity. The decision involved in the transactional immunity estate being Soriano, and I have a cite for it if you would like it, in 1984, and it said that under the Oregon Constitution, you simply cannot compel testimony under use immunity.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the case and I'm familiar with the issue now.
The language we have used is in our amendment is that was specifically cited by the court as an example of a transactional immunity statute that would be constitutional. As I understand Senate Bill 553, it attempts to tie it to the RICO statute and say that you can compel testimony and still use the civil procedures to get forfeiture. The attorney I've had researched this, and the person who did our amicus brief in State v. Soriano, thinks that under the analysis of Brown v. Multnomah County, which you may recall is the statute which dealt with making drunk driving first offense an infraction and so on, that the 553 proposed by the Justice Department raises very serious constitutional questions. That is, that the civil forfeiture might, under the Brown v. Multnomah County analysis,
result in such severe penalties that they would be considered as criminal rather than as civil in nature. We're not prepared to say absolutely that they're unconstitutional, but we think that it's
entitled. Where is Senate Bill 553?
Here.
Moves to that.
We've heard, but it's still in committee.
It's still in committee.
In addition to the transactional immunity, what is left in the bill that we introduced is a provision that deletes language held unconstitutional in Johnson et al. Versus Stewart et al. In 1984, after years of litigation, that prohibits the use or adoption of textbooks in schools in Oregon that, quote, speak slightingly of the founders of the Republic or those who fought to preserve the Union.
That's this bill.
Yes, all right.
Which is an unpublished opinion. We had originally had in the bill also the repealing of certain language in the harassment statute that had been found unconstitutional. That was deleted in the original bill by legislative council because there was another bill, which I believe is in your committee. Also, the decision that held that the obscenity statute relating to juveniles, that the provision that they declare, I mean, that it's illegal to provide any nudity to juveniles, was unconstitutional. Those were both taken out in the House because there were separate bills in by the Law Enforcement Council. The nudity bill died in committee without amendment or whatever, and they were unwilling to reinsert it. The harassment bill is an attempted amendment, which is before you. If those two bills don't pass, we really think that it is the only responsible thing to do to add these things and repeal them because they have already been declared unconstitutional.
Okay, but if the bills don't get through, the laws nonetheless are still unconstitutional.
Yes, they're unenforceable, but as you know, they are misleading to both prosecutors and police, and people get charged.
Okay. All right, well, thank you. I guess that's you're the witness on this bill, and so we'll declare the public hearing on 2663 to be at an end. And at 5:37, the Senate Judiciary Committee will be adjourned.
Going back to your date this weekend?
I don't know. I don't know what time is for session. And I'll decide. We're through by 8 o'clock, we're going to go back tonight.
Okay.